Good morning to each one. Greetings in Jesus' name. It's a blessing to be gathered in the house of God this morning and look into God's Word, look into different periods of time. The Old Testament was an age, a time, and God worked in and through His people in the Old Testament. Today we're living in the New Testament. Some things have changed and some things are still the same. You can open your Bibles to 1 Corinthians 10. The title of the message this morning is Run to Win. And that's actually taken from the end of chapter 9, but we'll get there as well. Run to Win. As children, young boys and girls, especially, I believe, most children like to run. They enjoy getting out there and running. Sometimes running for the pure joy of running, just for fun. But maybe there's at times when the teacher says you need to go out and run, and the student would rather just stay inside. Maybe it's cold outside. Maybe they just don't feel like running. That happens sometimes as well. Sometimes we run just for fun. Other times we run to win. We have a race. There's a goal. There's a prize at the end, and we run to compete. Sometimes we play for fun. Sometimes we compete to win. Sometimes we're skating, and this has happened a couple times this past week. You go skating, and you know, I remember as a boy, you could skate for 2 hours just for the pure joy of skating, and you wouldn't feel tired. Well, I found out the other night that skating for 2 minutes makes me feel tired, and I don't know what changed, but somehow we went from 2 hours to 2 minutes, but things change. And sometimes you skate just for the fun of skating, just to feel the wind blowing over your face and gliding across the ice. It's just fun. It's exhilarating. Other times you play a game and you play to compete, either games on the pond or hockey or something like that. I read an account once, an illustration in a book, and I tried to find it again, but I didn't remember which book it was in. But it was of an Olympic runner who was nearing the end of his time competing as he was growing older. And he was at the Olympic Games, and I believe he, as I recall the story, he excelled on short races more than long races. And they thought for sure he was going to take a medal in at least one or two of the shorter races. Well, he ran those races, and he didn't do well. He actually didn't medal at all. And people were a little bit surprised because he had a good chance to win the gold medal. Well, it was down to the last race that he was going to run in, which was a longer race. And people did not, you know, think that he was the one to win that race. And he decided that instead of running to compete, he's going to run just for the sheer joy of running, because he did love to run. And so when he started that race, instead of thinking about winning the race, he thought about the fun of running. And he actually won that race. He actually won the gold medal in that race. And it shows us that, yes, while we need to run, while in life we run this race, we run to win, we also run with joy. And the two coupled together can make for a successful race. Now, 1 Corinthians 10, 1 through 13 was actually the memory passage from last quarter's Sunday school lesson, as we looked at the children of Israel and their exodus, their journey out of Egypt. And it was the memory passage, and I worked at it some. I believe I could have, at that point anyway, said through it by memory. But there was a couple things that stood out to me. And as we continue into the study in Exodus, or now Leviticus and Numbers, through the Exodus of the children of Israel, the wilderness experience, some of those experiences we have yet to study, and they come up in this passage. Some of them we looked at already. But if you get down to verse 11... it says, now all these things happened unto them for and samples. And then this little phrase, and they are written for our admonition. They are written for our admonition. They are written for our learning, for our instruction, for our warnings. These warnings were given to us, warnings from the children of Israel's history. Now, the chapter begins with "moreover," and it tells us it is a continuation of the thought before that. And so I went back to look at the thought before that. And beginning in verse 24, it talks about running a race. He says, "Know ye not that they which run in a race run all, but one receiveth the prize? So run that ye may obtain, or so run that ye may win. And every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. I therefore so run, not as uncertainly, so fight I, not as one that beateth the air, but I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway." And we could spend probably the rest of the sermon looking at this concept of running, the concept of training, concept of self-discipline and denial, all things that an athlete does if they want to compete at the highest level. Now, there are many people that would desire the skills and the ability and maybe the fame and the glory of an Olympic athlete that can win a gold medal, or maybe some team that can win a championship. There are many people, and maybe we even ourselves would aspire to be able to do those things, to run or to skate or to shoot a basketball or catch a football or whatever it is. We want to be good at those things. But many of us, probably most of us, probably all of us, and many people alike, are not willing to go to the hard work that it takes to get there. All that we see is the fun, the enjoyment, maybe it looks appealing to be able to compete at a high level. But we forget about the hard work, the discipline, the self-denial, the being temperate in all things, the moderation that those people bring into their lives and allow to be a part of their life in order that they can compete. But Paul here says that it takes a lot of work. He had a plan. He had a purpose. His purpose was to reach the goal, to win. And because he saw that, because he had a vision, a plan to reach the prize at the end, he said he's going to do some things in his life to make that plan a reality. Last Sunday, I believe it was, Anthony preached on faith, commitment, and endurance, and a lot of good thoughts, and he shared on the some of the history of the Anabaptist movement, and Brendan referred to that as well. We're not going to spend a lot of time looking at that this morning, but I did reflect on that just a bit as we hit this mark here on Tuesday of the 500th anniversary of Anabaptism, as it's referred to, as it's the date when Conrad Grebel baptized George Blaurock, and then George Blaurock baptized some of the other men at that meeting. And following that, there were others that joined the Anabaptist faith, the Anabaptist movement, and there were many that were faithful to the end, even through cruel persecution and even to the point of losing their life with cruel treatment. But then there were others that didn't make it, that recanted, that renounced their faith, or for some other reason fell away. They failed to finish the race. I just have one story here of a George Bauman. It says that 4 years after Anabaptism began, George Bauman was arrested and imprisoned in Germany for being an Anabaptist. While he was in prison, the authorities put him on the rack to try to make him recant. The rack is a dreadful instrument of pain in which a prisoner is slowly stretched by arms and legs. When the pain became extreme, Bauman broke down and agreed the Anabaptist faith was wrong. They demanded that he renounce his faith 3 times in the state church. Twice he went and made confession. Before Bauman made his 3rd confession, he came to himself. Martyr's Mirror tells us that he thought about where he was going. See, he thought about the race. He thought about where he was going and what would honor God. So when he arrived at the state church the 3rd time, he said to everyone, "You have condemned me, and through pain and fear prevailed upon me to follow you. But now I renounce and revoke it all. I am sorry that I did it. I regret that I recanted. I am going to be a true Anabaptist and follow Christ all the way." The priests and officials said to each other, "Why should we wait to punish him?" They arrested George and quickly sentenced him to death. As he was led to the place of beheading, he sang joyfully, It was very muddy in the village, but despite the mud, he walked briskly. His shoes got stuck fast in the mud, but he took no notice of it and continued on his way barefooted. He was committed to Christ and sang for joy that God had given him such courage and heart. So there was a man that at one point in his life, he gave up. He diverted off the path, off the track, off the running track, the race, but he realized he got off track, and he got back on track again. Here we are, nearly 500 years later. Today, there are still believers that are persecuted, even to the point of death, for their faith in Christ. But that's not how it is here in America. It's different in our situation. We have religious freedom. We have peace here. But the question is, will we stay on track? Will we continue running the race? See, there are other ways that we can lose out. Well, those who were persecuted and died for the faith did not lose out. They lost their life, but they did not lose out. Today, we have the choice. Are we going to run the race to win, or will we lose out? The children of Israel had a new start when they came out of Egypt, and I don't remember how many it was. I think somewhere it says maybe 6 million men, besides women and children. Not sure on that note, on that number, but how many people actually made it to Canaan? There was still a number that made it. How many people lost out? And if you look at the history of the Israelites, you go 500 years later, how many people were still serving God and following God with a heart of love for him? And the question for us today is, are we continuing on faithful? Many people have not remained faithful through the last 500 years. Elsewhere, Paul, when he was speaking about bonds and affliction, he says, "But none of these things move me, neither count I my life dear unto myself, so that I may finish my course, or I may finish the race with joy, and the ministry which I have received of the Lord Jesus to testify the gospel of the grace of God." So in 1 Corinthians 10, verses 1 through 13, we'll read that in just a moment. But verse 12 says, "Wherefore, as you consider everything that he has written," or the things that he had written before this, "wherefore, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall." And, you know, I think all of us feel like we have an ability to stand of ourselves. We have some perseverance. Maybe we have some disciplines in our life, and we know what we want to do. But it says to take heed. Take heed. If you think you're standing firm, just be careful, because you might fall. These things were written for us, for an example, for a type, for a pattern that we can look at and realize that if we do these things, that the Israelites, if we fail, if we fall like the Israelites did, then there's going to be repercussions. There's going to be judgment. We're going to lose out. It is an admonition. It is a warning to us who are living in this age. It's a different age than the children of Israel lived in, but there's many things that are still the same. Just take the time to read the first 13 verses here of 1 Corinthians 10. "Moreover, brethren, I would not that ye should be ignorant how that all our fathers were under the cloud, and all passed through the sea, and were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and did all eat the same spiritual meat, and did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them. That rock was Christ. But with many of them God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now these things were our examples, to the intent we should not lust after evil things, as they also lusted. Neither be ye idolaters, as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink, and rose up to play. Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed, and fell in one day 23,000. Neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted, and were destroyed of serpents. Neither murmur ye, as some of them also murmured, and were destroyed of the destroyer. Now all these things happened unto them for ensamples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. Wherefore, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that ye are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape, that you may be able to bear it." Now, just beginning at the beginning of the chapter, he talks about how all of them faced a similar experience, and all of them had the same provision, and all of them passed through the sea, and all of them were under the cloud. We know how God guided them with a pillar of cloud, cloud by day and fire by night. But he says that all of Israel had this opportunity. All of them had this experience. All of them had food to eat. They had water to drink. Even at times when they thought they weren't going to have anything, God met their needs and God supplied their needs. But beyond that, it says that it was a spiritual, not only a physical sustenance, but also a spiritual sustenance. He talks about the spiritual rock and the spiritual drink. And in Deuteronomy 8, verse 3, it says that God humbled them and suffered them to hunger and fed them with manna, which thou knowest not, neither did thy fathers know, that he might make thee know that man doth not live by bread only, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of the Lord doth man live. And we often think about the physical sustenance that God provided for the Israelites when he gave them manna and when he gave them water from the rock or provided water in some other way. But here in Deuteronomy, it says that God was trying to teach them that man doesn't live by bread alone and that there are other more important things. And as he led them through the wilderness, he was trying to teach them this lesson, to follow the spiritual rock, to eat of the spiritual rock and to drink of the spiritual rock. But he says, even though they all had this opportunity and this privilege, he says that with many of them, God was not well pleased. Most of them failed in one way or another, and God was not pleased with them. And it says that they were overthrown in the wilderness. And we know how that as they approached the land of Canaan and they chose not to proceed and not to go in, not to follow God's plan. And because of that, God had them wander in the wilderness for 40 years. And it says that your carcasses shall fall in the wilderness and all that were numbered of you according to your whole number from 20 years old and upward, which have murmured against me. So they were overthrown. They were destroyed in the wilderness, as it says here. And then he tells us in verse 6 that these things are for our example. It's a type for us to pay attention, to learn from, to realize that if we do the same thing, if we repeat the same mistakes, that we're going to fail as well. We should not lust after evil things. And lust simply means to set our heart upon or long for or desire. And Mark 4, I think it's where Jesus is giving the parable of the sower. He talks about how some seed is sown among thorns. And he says, those are people, that is like people that hear the word, but the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches and the lusts of other things entering in choke the word and it become unfruitful. Now, we often think of lust in regards to immorality. Sexual immorality. But lust is more than that. Lust is when our hearts desire something that they shouldn't have, and we set our hearts upon them, and we long after them. And we know that that is what happened in the children of Israel's situation. They set their hearts on something better, something different, something that God did not see fit to give them in the moment. And so Paul takes these examples, and he teaches the church at Corinth lessons that they can learn from these examples. And you would think, as you look at the issues that Paul hits, you would think that he was speaking to the church of 2025, the church today. The reality is that the heart of man is still the same. The heart of the Israelites, the heart of the church at Corinth, the heart of us today, man today, is still the same. And even though technology changes and things maybe advance or become different, our circumstances are different, there's still the heart of man that is the same. Man's fallen nature is still the same. And today the devil uses many of the same tactics and maybe different circumstances, but he still appeals to the heart, to the fallen nature of man, and the battle is still won or lost in the heart. So I'd like to look at these warnings that are given to the children of Israel, or to the Corinthians, as they look at the children of Israel's history, and think about the lessons, the warnings that we can take from them today. The first one is the warning against idolatry. And we have that here in verse 7. It says, "Neither be ye idolaters, as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play." And that's a reference to the golden calf experience there at Mount Sinai. As Moses went up the mountain, and the children of Israel waited, and they got tired of waiting, and they wondered what happened to Moses, and when he was going to come down again. And they went to Aaron, and they asked him to make this calf for them, this God that can lead them. And it says in Exodus 32, verse 6, "And they rose up early on the morrow." This was after they made the calf. "They rose up, they offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play." And we could say, well, what today we don't have idols, we don't have images. Idolatry simply means image worship. Or do we? Are there some things in my life that distract me from what I should be looking at, from my focus on God? Are there some, see, faith looks at that which is not seen. It takes an eye of faith to see things that are unseen, things that are realities, but yet they are unseen realities, and it's only visible by faith. But so many times my natural sight is drawn away to things that I can actually see. And the eye of faith, the vision of faith, the view of faith is trumped by a physical sight. And that's what the children of Israel, they wanted a golden calf. They wanted something they could see, something that they could put their eyes on to remind them, they said, of the God that brought them up out of Egypt. And there are many things that we could put our eyes on today that distract us from the prize, that will divert us from the race, that will cause us to take a detour, or worse than a detour, cause us to take another route, another path, a path that does not lead to the prize. Philippians 3 says, "For many walk, of whom I have told you often, and now tell you even weeping, that they are the enemies of the cross of Christ, whose end is destruction, whose God is their belly, and whose glory is in their shame." And then he says this, who mind earthly things. That's the physical eyes of man. We look at earthly things, and our heart is quickly drawn to earthly things. He says, whose God is their belly. And so it could be food. That could be literally the food, the abundance of food that we have could become a god to us. But it could be more than that. What do we feed on? What do we fill our minds with? What do we read and follow and watch and listen to? You know, those things can become idols, the pursuits that we have. Those, the things that we feed upon, can quickly become an idol. Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the pleasures of Babylon. And in that particular instance, it was referring to the dainties, the food, the kingly food that was offered to them. And he purposed to not defile himself with these dainties of Babylon. But I know it went much further than only denying himself of food. There were other ways that he denied himself of the pleasures that Babylon offered. And in doing that, he did not allow his heart to be drawn away. As we see here with the children of Israel, idols first take our money, and then they take our time. See, first they threw their gold, gave their gold to Moses, or to Aaron, and this golden calf was made. So it took their money, first of all, but then it also took their time. They needed to spend time feasting and seeking pleasure and eating and drinking. And it is the same for us today when we put our money into something that takes our hearts, then it also takes our time as well, and we lose focus of the God of heaven and what he wants from us. And so the warning against idolatry. The second warning given here is the warning against sexual immorality. And it says here in verse 8, "Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed, and fell in one day 23,000. Now the instance that it is referring to is in Numbers 25, and I don't think we'll read many verses from there, but this happened directly after Balaam went with Balak. Balak was the king of Moab, and he came and he requested that Balaam would come and curse the children of Israel as they came to the land of Moab. And we know what happened in that story. Balaam was first told that he can't go, and then he was allowed to go, and they had that situation there where the angel stood in front of him as he tried to go. But finally he went, and then when he stood on the mountain to curse Israel, as Balak wanted him to do, he instead blessed Israel because he said he could only say what God revealed to him to say. But apparently there was something else that happened in that situation that we were informed a bit later on. Well, it tells us that immediately following after that, that there were men of Israel that worshipped Baal Peor and engaged in sexual immorality with the Moabite women. This happened directly after the account of Balaam and his blessing Israel instead of cursing them. But these men became involved with the Moabite women, both in worship and in sexual immorality. And the Lord's anger was kindled against them, and he ordered that all of them be killed. And there's a couple chapters later when Israel did fight with Midian, or with Moab, I believe it was. And Moses, and when the men fought, they brought back some of the stuff, and they also brought back some of the women. And Moses said unto them, "Have ye saved all the women alive? Behold, these caused the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to commit trespass against the Lord in the matter of Peor. And there was a plague among the congregation of the Lord." And he tells us there that Balaam gave them some advice or some counsel as to how they could get Israel to fall. Even though he couldn't curse them, apparently he gave them some advice, because it says that through the counsel of Balaam to commit trespass against the Lord. And Revelation 2 confirms this in the letter to the church at Pergamos. It says, "But I have a few things against thee, because thou hast there them that hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed unto idols, and commit fornication." And it's a bit of the story that I never connected with the story of Balaam before, how that even though he could not curse Israel, he apparently gave Balaam advice of how he could get Israel to fall. And Israel fell. Many men committed adultery and fell. 1 Corinthians 6, we read these verses in our Sunday school class this morning, but it wasn't these verses. 1 Corinthians 6, verse 18, we read from 2 Corinthians, but 1 Corinthians 6, 18 says, "Flee fornication. Every sin that a man doeth is without the body, but he that committeth fornication sinneth against his own body. What? Know ye not that your body is the temple of the Holy Ghost, which is in you, which ye have of God, and ye are not your own? For ye are bought with a price. Therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's." And there's the call to a life of purity and a life of integrity. You know, the opportunity was there for the children of Israel for them to fall, and some of them fell. I'm sure that not all of them fell, but some of them fell. The opportunities today for sexual immorality and impurity are rampant around us. And we could ask, as we read the account of the children of Israel, we could say, how could they do something like this? Like, what? How could they get to the point where they would actually commit adultery, where they would actually practice these things and commit this sin? Well, I don't know exactly how they got to that point, but I do know that the heart of man is still the same. And I'm sure that they took the short view. They looked at what they wanted to do right now. They looked at how they could find fulfillment and satisfaction immediately, instant gratification and pleasure. And they took their eyes off the goal. See, the race that we're running is not won in an hour or in a day or a week or a month or a year. The race that we're running, for most of us, is many, many years. And the goal is out there quite a way. But too often we take the short view and we say, what do I want to do? What would feel good to do right now? What would I enjoy doing right now? We take our eyes off the goal. And in doing that, we lose the race. Like Joseph, we must ask, how then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? 1 Corinthians here tells us that we're sinning against our body, which we are. Joseph also recognized that the sin, committing a sin like that, would be sinning against God. And it's a moral failure that is not only against us, but is also against a holy God. And so he gives him this warning against sexual immorality. The third warning that he gives is the warning against testing Christ. And he says in verse 9, neither let us tempt Christ or test Christ, as some of them also tempted or tested and were destroyed as serpents. And Numbers 21 says, and they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to compass the land of Edom, and the soul of the people was much discouraged because of the way. And we can understand why they would be discouraged. It was difficult. The road was hard. It was hot. It was dry. It was tiresome. The food, well, they go on to talk about the food, and the people speak against God and against Moses. Wherefore have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no bread, neither is there any water, and our soul loatheth this light bread. And the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and much people of Israel died. But they were discouraged. And that is normal human experience, especially when you're in a wilderness journey. And they said there was no bread, but then they said their soul loatheth this light bread. So apparently there was probably manna. But it was the same old thing. And they were tired of it. They were weary. And the race that they were running or walking was grueling. And they questioned God. They tested God. They tested Christ. And they said, why did you bring us out here into the wilderness to die? And they said, God, if you could bring us here, why are we going through such a difficult situation? Well, life is not always easy. There are difficult times. In 2 Corinthians 12, where Paul gives his testimony, he talks about his thorn in the flesh, and he says, for this thing I besought the Lord thrice, that it might depart from me. And he said unto me, my grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake, for when I am weak, then am I strong. Now that goes exactly or entirely against what our natural human nature, our natural human self wants to have in life. We don't want difficulties. We don't want reproaches. We don't want persecutions. We don't want distresses. But Paul says if they are for Christ's sake, then he's okay with it and he'll accept it. If it's the path that God has us to walk, then we need to accept it instead of crying out in against God and against Christ, as the children of Israel did here. They speak against God and against Moses, and they challenge God as to why he brought them out in the wilderness to die. And at times we may be tempted to challenge God for the situation that he has brought us into. But there's a reason that he has us there. There's a reason that he has us walking the path that we are walking. Our natural tendency is to give up. Job's wife recommended of Job that he curse God and die. And that is a natural feeling when we get to a situation like this. But Paul says that he was going to endure for Christ's sake. And endurance is the only way that we can win the prize. The fourth warning that he gives us here is in verse 10, where it says, neither murmur ye, as some of them also murmured, and were destroyed of the destroyer. Now, murmuring is complaining, and that is certainly what some of them did at various times. I believe in particular, it's talking about a murmur or a complaint against authority. And so I label this warning as a warning against being critical of authority. A warning against being critical of authority. In number 16, I think we're just going to turn back there and look at this passage a little bit. Number 16 is the account where Korah, Dathan, and Abiram rose up and challenged the authority of Moses and Aaron. And there was 250 other leaders, it calls them princes, that also rallied behind or with Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And their complaint or their challenge in verse 3 was that, talking to Moses and Aaron, they said, "Ye take too much upon you." And they just were telling them that you are taking too much authority and too much power. God has spoken to the rest of us as well. And there's no reason that you need to be an authority over us, because God has spoken and is among us as well. And Moses, of course, was grieved by this, and Moses responded in a very humble way. It says that he fell upon his face. He did not challenge them, but he went to God. He fell upon his face. Later on in the chapter, verse 12, Moses called to Dathan and Abiram and invited them to come. And let's talk about this. Let's discuss this. Let's see what our differences are and try and work through this. Well, their response was, "We will not come. We are not going to come and talk to you. We are above talking to you about this situation, because we feel like we are in authority or have as much authority as you do." Well, God was not happy with them, and it sounds like he was ready to consume the whole congregation. If you go down to verse 21, talking to Moses and Aaron, he said, "To separate yourselves from among this congregation that I may consume them in a moment." And they, Aaron and Moses, fell upon their faces and said, "O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin, and wilt thou be wroth with the whole congregation?" And it sounds like God was ready to destroy the whole congregation except for Moses and Aaron. And Moses and Aaron interceded and fell before God. And God instead brought punishment, judgment upon Korah, Dathan, and Abiram and their families. And as the story goes, he told the rest of the people to move away from them because they were going to be judged. And the ground opened up. And it swallowed them alive. They were buried alive, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, and their families. And then fire came down and consumed the 250 other leaders who were other men who were part of this uprising. And God just spoke very clearly and very plainly and said that Moses and Aaron were called to be an authority, and that these men did have the authority to direct the children of Israel as God directed them. Well, if you go down to verse 41 of Numbers chapter 16, so at one day the judgment came where their families, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, and their families were buried alive, and the 250 other men were killed, consumed by fire. This was all the work of the Lord, okay? This was not Moses and Aaron's doings. It was the work of the Lord. Well, it says in verse 41, "But on the morrow," the next day, tomorrow, "all the congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron, saying, 'Ye have killed the people of the Lord.'" Now, how long does it take these people to understand that God was not happy with this kind of action and this kind of attitude? So the next day they come and they say to Moses and Aaron, you went and killed the people of the Lord, people that apparently were more righteous and maybe more holy than Moses and Aaron themselves. Well, the glory of the Lord again came down to the tabernacle. The cloud covered it. God told Moses again to step away. Verse 45, "Get you up from among this congregation that I may consume them as in a moment." And again, Moses and Aaron fell upon their faces. And as judgment started passing through the congregation of Israel, Moses told Aaron to get his censer and put fire in it from the altar and to quickly go into the congregation and spread it among the people. And it says that stopped the plague, and it stopped. He went between the living and the dead. But until all that happened, there was, there was 14,700 people killed on that day, in addition to the ones that had died the day before. But there was many people that lost their lives that day because they were critical of authority and because they spoke out and rose up against authority. You know, leaders are not perfect. Leaders are men. Moses and Aaron were not perfect leaders, but yet they were called of God. They had a purpose. Leaders have a purpose. And leaders sometimes can get out of their place, and that is evidenced by Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, and the men that followed them. There are some times that leaders will get out of their place. But God spoke clearly, and he said that I have put these men in authority. I put Moses and Aaron in authority. And being critical or criticizing them is not acceptable. Moses and Aaron were on trial by others. The rest of the congregation, at least some of the congregation, were holding them on trial. And God was angry about it. God was not happy about it. And he was prepared to consume them in a moment, and they would have been gone if it were not for the intercession of the very men that they had an issue with. The people would have been destroyed. And it is common or normal or natural for us to criticize people that are in authority. As I said, people in authority do not always make the right decision, do not always come to the right conclusion, and do make some mistakes at times. But God speaks strongly against holding them on trial for what they are doing as they see best and as they try to lead as God calls them to. And God is not okay with people saying, "Who are you to tell me what to do?" Or, "You made the wrong move. You dealt with the wrong person, and you dealt with it the wrong way." There is times that we can discuss that, and we can work through those things for sure. But to have an attitude that you're on trial because you have not done something right, that's what Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, that's how they acted. And God was not pleased with them, was not happy with them. And the next day, the rest of the congregation came and said, "You know, you did the wrong thing. You killed God's people." And again, God was not happy with their actions. Leaders are not perfect, but leaders do serve a purpose. And he gives them this warning against criticizing, being critical of leaders and the role that they fill and the work that they do. Well, verse 13, back in 1 Corinthians 10, it talks about the temptations that will come. And we know that we will be tempted. We will be tempted in these areas of idolatry. We will be tempted in areas of immorality. And we'll be tempted in areas of testing and questioning God. We'll be tempted in areas of being critical towards authority. We will be tempted. And sometimes those temptations are brought on by ourselves and by our own choices and desires and our own actions. Other times, maybe it comes to us and we had no... there was nothing on our part that brought it upon us, but Satan brought this temptation into our circumstances and into our lives. But no matter how the temptation comes, there is a way to escape. God has a path to escape. The race that we're running has a path straight ahead, straight forward toward the prize, toward the goal. We do not have to take the diversion. We do not have to lose out because of the temptation. We can instead choose the way of escape. We are running the race today. Today it is our turn. Thousands of years after the wilderness experience, we are living today, and 500 years after the birth of the Anabaptist church. Many in that time period have been distracted and have lost out, never to finish the race and to claim the prize. The question for us is, how will our story read? What will our story be like? Whether it's thousands of years from now, whether it's 500 years from now, you know, it doesn't seem like God's plan would be to continue life on earth for that long. But if he would, you know, how will our story read? How will our race, end? And we don't have to wait. We won't be waiting 500 years to find out. It could be in a moment. It could be at any time. But at some point, our race will be over, and will we run so that we can obtain a prize? Let's kneel for prayer.